The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why does Lola Wicks leave Afghanistan?
Lola falls victim to what's happening throughout the newspaper industry, which is this draconian wave of layoffs and cutbacks. She is based in Kabul. She's in a foreign bureau, and many, many newspapers, including my old one, the Philadelphia Inquirer, have cut all of their foreign bureaus and all of their national bureaus. And that happens to her in a particularly egregious way. She's actually out of Kabul into the highlands, working on something she has worked weeks to set up, traveling with a rebel faction. And she gets a call from an editor in the middle of the night that says, "Drop all of that, come straight home." She's not happy.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Gwen Florio about her mystery novel titled Montana. So we'll get back to Lola Wicks in a minute, but first let's talk about you a little bit. Until very recently, you also were a journalist, a reporter with the Missoulian newspaper. How did you make the transition from journalist to novelist?
You know, it was not as tough as I thought it would be. I had been in journalism 37 years. I've been writing fiction or working at writing fiction probably for 20 of those years. So it was a long, slow movement toward that. I loved journalism. I loved it right up till the very last day I did it. But since I've left, I haven't missed it, and I think that's a sign that I was ready.
This first book, Montana, you didn't have a home office when you wrote it, so tell us about writing that book.
Break Espresso, my second home. I owe it to many, many soy lattes, many soy lattes. Yeah, I would go there and write. I actually did have a home office of sorts, but it was in the basement and I hated it. And I finally, we changed around a second bedroom upstairs and I became much happier then when I had sunlight and air in the room. And now I work mostly from home, but I still go back to the break once in a while for old time's sake.
And you have to get your latte.
And I have to get my latte. I know my latte consumption went down considerably once I started working at home.
You, like Lola, have also worked in Afghanistan and I think Somalia and Iraq. How long were you there and what kind of stories were you working on?
My experience was very different than hers. I made Lola a true foreign correspondent where she was based in the country that she covered. I spent a few years with the Denver Post kind of parachuting into these places after 9/11. They really wanted to try and get a handle on what was happening around the world. So I would go in for a few weeks. I think the longest I was in Afghanistan and Pakistan combined might have been 4 or 5 weeks. I went there twice, went to Somalia, did a number of countries in the Middle East, covering different aspects of what we then called the War on Terror.
So what brought you to Montana?
Oh, what has brought so many people to Montana? I came here on vacation many years ago, got off the plane, looked around, and said, I have got to find a way to live here. It took me a long time to find a job here that would allow that.
Well, one thing that got my attention in the book was the way Lola slept when she was in Afghanistan. She did not get undressed and crawl into bed.
No, she slept in her sleeping bag, and that's something I borrowed from real life. It was just so touchy and tenuous there that I slept fully dressed. It was also so cold there that not only was I fully dressed, but when I was done using my laptop, which I had to attach to a generator to use, I would put it in the bottom of my sleeping bag and then put my feet on it to keep my feet warm. And the other thing that I also borrowed for Lola, when I would come back home, it took me a while to stop sleeping in the sleeping bag. You got so used to having this cocoon wrapped around you that a bed felt a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, Lola also slept in her boots.
When I think back on that, that's probably a bit much, although where she was, she needed to be able to jump and run at any minute because you just didn't know what was going to happen.
Right. As you mentioned, Lola Wicks' assignment in Afghanistan has been canceled, and she's been having a really hard time accepting that and adjusting to life back in the U.S. So there's a passage near the beginning of the book that describes all of that, which I'd like you to read. Starts with her speaking to her editor on page 16.
And this is when she has just arrived back in Baltimore, which is where I put her newspaper, and she is fresh off the plane. And again, deeply unhappy. In Baltimore, an editor, one of the new ones, tilted back in his chair and avoided her eyes. It's not personal, he said. We're shuttering all the foreign bureaus. We'll find you something here, maybe in one of the suburban offices. The layoffs left us pretty thin out there. At least you'll still have a job. Consider yourself lucky. Lola examined a paperweight of milky swirled glass that sat between a file and a newspaper on his desk. It looked heavy. She picked it up. It was. The suburbs. Lucky me. Floor-to-ceiling windows formed one wall of the office, the legacy of a newsroom renovation dating to the days when profits sloshed through the paper, spilling over into heralded new foreign bureaus, year-long prize-savvy investigative projects, and wink-and-nod expense accounts. That tide had swept out a long time ago, leaving behind pay cuts and layoffs and unpaid furloughs. Packing boxes sat atop several desks in the newsroom. Others looked as though they'd been bare for months. Stubborn cracks left unrepaired veined the tall windows. Grit dulled their surface. The popcorn burst of automatic weapons fire sounded faintly through them, and Lola counted silently, reckoning the distance, before she saw the man hunched at the curb, a jackhammer anchoring his bobbling torso. I'd be reporting on school boards, Lola said, zoning hearings. Neighbors pointing lawyers at each other over a foot of property line. She tossed the paperweight high. It dropped into her palm with a satisfying sting. There'll be some of that. It's what people care about. Interns cover that crap. We don't have interns anymore. Haven't for 3 or 4 years now. You've been overseas a long time. You don't even have a smartphone, do you? We've got plenty of younger reporters in the suburbs who can get you up to speed on the technology. Look, would you mind putting that down? It's expensive. His cheeks were pink and smooth, his shirt starched and palely gleaming against the fine dark weave of his blazer. Lola tried to remember a life that allowed for easy cleanliness. She straightened her legs, taking up too much room in the too small office, the scuffed toes of her cleated hiking boots nearly touching his pretty polished loafers. Standing, she had 6 inches on him. You can't pull me out now, she said. The warlords are rearming. Somewhere, somehow, somebody's getting money to them, a lot of money. Not to put too fine a point on it, but what's going on there is going to determine the course of history for the next decade at the very least. You know that. And yet you put today's story from Afghanistan on... She exchanged the paperweight for the newspaper. She turned the pages, counting aloud. Page one, nope. Two, no, not there either. Three, four. Oh, here's something about everyone twittering a crotch shot of an actress with no undies. That one's right above a story about a massacre in Congo. Glad to see you've got your priorities in order. Tweeting. What? Never mind. The wire services can cover Afghanistan. Damn it. She rolled up the paper and slapped it against his desk. The paperweight shuddered. The wire services aren't getting the job done. They've had layoffs, too, in case you haven't noticed. The only guy the AP's got left in Kabul is too scared to leave the city. He does most of his work by phone. But I'm out there where it's all happening. Was there until you called. He reached across the desk and took the newspaper from her. Our readers care more about how a property tax increase is going to affect them right now than they do about how things in Afghanistan are going to shake out in 10 years. He opened the file and slid some forms from it. You've got some, a lot, of time off coming. You haven't taken a vacation in years. It's really played hell with our accounting. You have to take it. Go get some R&R. Lola hefted the paperweight again and looked at the ceiling. I'll take it back in Kabul. Softball amounts to R&R. I play a lot of softball. I'm the pitcher on the Kabul Kabooms. We're on track to take the championship away from the Talibanary. Her hand flashed. The paperweight shot up and rocketed back down. She snatched it from the air above his head. Do you really want the Italians to beat us at our own game? Good God! He righted himself in the chair. All of you correspondents are a pain in the ass when you come back. It's June. The way I count up all this time, we got to give you something like 10 weeks off with pay. That'll take you until nearly September. You should be housebroken again by then. Take that vacation. Given that we budgeted for flights home that you never took, we'll pay plane fare, within reason. Don't go to Tahiti, and don't run up a big hotel bill. Go someplace where you can sponge off friends. Put that damn thing down. I don't know anybody here anymore. You laid them all off. Except for one who beat you to the punch. She realized too late that she'd given him an opening. Who's that? Mary Alice Carr, she said slowly, wishing she'd thought to offer up another name. She left a few years ago, back when this place was still giving buyouts. Before your time, I think. But he nodded. I remember her. She left right after I got here. Went to some crazy place. Idaho, Wyoming, something like that. She called us a couple of weeks ago. Montana. What does she want? She was all excited about something happening out there, trying to sell us the story. Some delusional person sent her my way. He grimaced. She didn't know we'd gone all local in our news coverage. No reason to buy a national story. No freelance budget for one anyway, even if we'd been interested, which we weren't. Lola stood. I really got the whole summer off? Legally, we've got to give you the time, something I'm short on. He looked pointedly at the message light blinking on his phone. Go to Montana, then. Fly fish, ride horses, whatever it is they do out there. We still have a travel agent. I'll have her make the arrangements before they cancel that contract, too. I don't fish, Lola said, and I don't like horses. I don't see why it's a problem for me just to go back to Cabo and finish up what I was working on. I'll see you in September. Like hell she would. But first she had to get back. She could figure out how to stay later. He pushed his chair back. I don't think you understand, he said. You are finished over there. You can drop off your laptop and satellite phone with the clerk. You won't need them anymore. As of the minute you walk through this door, we no longer have any more foreign bureaus. I left the sat phone in Cabo along with my body armor and all the rest of my stuff. I should go back and get it. Nice try, he said. Just have those French freaks you live with. The ones who think it's so funny to answer your phone and hang up on me when I try to call, ship your stuff. You're not going back. We've already canceled your company credit card and the travel account. He kept talking, but Lola's focus shifted to a panel truck, the perfect size to hold a dozen oil drums packed with a sludgy mix of fertilizer and racing fuel, moving slowly past the building. Lola stared hard at the driver, watching for the quick yank at the wheel that would send the truck into the lobby, the thumb to the detonator that would follow. The concussive force would bend the newsroom windows outward, the panes bubbling like a soapy mass across the face of the building, then suck them back in with such speed and intensity that the glass would burst, shards shooting across the office, razoring through furniture, paper, flesh. Lola blew out a breath, slammed the door behind her, and strode the length of the underpopulated newsroom, the stupid expensive paperweight in her pocket, banging against her thigh with each step.
You've been listening to Gwen Florio read from Montana, the first in a series of crime mysteries. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. We'll be back after a short break to talk more about the book. Don't go away. When Lola arrives in Montana, she ends up renting a car and driving from the airport. And one of the things that she notices is the meth billboards, the anti-meth billboards. Why is she so disturbed by those, or why doesn't she like them?
I think she just finds them a little tacky. Sort of the opposite of what you want the Chamber of Commerce to project when you visit a place.
So the tourist arrives in Montana, and instead of taking in the mountain scenery, they see a story about meth use.
Right. You're in a giant drug den now. Yeah. Welcome to Montana.
So aside from the billboards, when Lola arrives in Montana, Tell us what happens when she comes into the town. I think, if I remember correctly, there was a 3-block-long business district in this little town. And describe what happens when she comes into town. Who does she meet, and what does it look like to her?
You know, the town is, as you noticed, is very small. It's only this small business district, and it's late in the evening. It's starting to get dark. It's in the summertime, so again, it is pretty late. Some of the stores have closed signs on them, and they look as though they're closed for the night. Some look as though they've been shut down forever. So you get a sense that this town is not doing well. The only place that's open is the typical gas station convenience store. And she goes in there, and the woman behind the counter, as soon as she stops to ask for directions up to Mary Alice's cabin, immediately knows who she is, and that kind of rocks her back. You know, again, she's been in a foreign place for so long that she's forgotten what it's like, especially in a small town where everybody knows everyone else and they know their business.
Mary Alice had come into the store and talked about her before she got there.
Sure. You know, my friend is coming to town. I'm very excited, that sort of thing. So people knew about that.
And they knew who Lola was simply mm-hmm. because she was someone they didn't recognize.
Right.
As part of your career, it says in your bio that you also worked in Wyoming.
I had this wonderful job, which eventually led me to Montana, back when the Philadelphia Inquirer had national and farm bureaus. I was the Denver bureau, and my territory was everything from Montana all the way down to the Mexican border. I spent the vast majority of my time in Montana, and every so often my editors would say, you know, go to Texas. You need to go to Texas. But one of the great pleasures of that job was going to places like Lost Springs. I did a story on tiny towns in Wyoming, because Wyoming has more incorporated towns of under 10 people than any other state in the country, which is not a huge surprise. And that's what brought me to Lost Springs. And I had a great time going to these places. You know, and part of that job involved either, you know, spending an hour or 2-hour plane flight to someplace and then driving another 4 hours to get where I was going. But again, it let me, you know, I got paid to explore the rural West, which to me is the best thing imaginable.
How long were you a reporter in Montana?
I came to Montana in 2005 and just quit this year. So 8 years, not quite 8 years. I started off in the Great Falls Tribune's Helena Bureau, and then after a couple years, I came to the Missoulian.
What do you see as the most important issues for people in Montana and surrounding states to pay attention to?
God. Sort of the same things that are affecting the rest of the country. You know, I think here particularly you have the issue of relatively low wages and relatively expensive housing. That's something that struck me right away when I moved here. If you travel a lot, it's phenomenally expensive to leave. You know, if you're going to get on a plane and go anywhere, you're going to pay a premium. That's kind of not an issue for everybody, but it's an issue. Healthcare, a huge issue. I think economic issues are big, obviously. Environmental issues are big, especially with extraction industries. That's a bigger issue now with what's happening out in the Bakken. You know, I could go on forever there. It's just such a rich environment for journalists.
I notice your next book is titled Dakota. Will Lola go to the Bakken?
Lola goes to the Bakken, and we went out there this summer to check it out as a research trip. The book actually is set in the wintertime, but I was not going to go to North Dakota in January.
Oh, come on.
I know.
Where's your sense of adventure?
I'm a weenie.
I lived for 3 years in North Dakota through three winters.
Hats off to you.
Okay, I'm going to have you read another short passage.
Sure.
Let's hear you read just the first 3 pages of the book. You call it a prologue, but that's where we'll meet Mary Alice.
Right. A stick snapping beneath a hard-soled boot sounds like nothing else in the woods. Mary Alice Carr spent much of the night on the slope above her cabin, wide-eyed and upright, back braced against a rolled sleeping bag, the minutes an inky ooze of boredom cut by fear, the hours flowing so slow and dreamlike that when the crack reverberated through the darkness, she wondered if she'd conjured it from the thin mountain air. Beside her, the young dog raised his head. She'd heard right then. The cabin stood against a rocky bluff on one of the rare level shelves where the northern Rockies break their headlong surge toward the sky, out of the path of the unremitting wind whose default force was a full-on gale. The wind's relentless onslaught scoured the land's surface, sculpting strange and brooding shapes out of the local limestone. It toughened the region's animal inhabitants into fierce and predatory opportunists and caused the human ones, upon occasion, to burst into inexplicable tears. But at dawn, the wind lay down, gathering strength for the day's battering siege. Here and there, sounds rose up, sudden and distinct. Dry needles sifting from the lodgepole pines, a coyote's trailing refrain, footfalls across the cabin's porch. The half-grown border collie vibrated low and tense beneath Mary Alice's hand. She closed her fingers around his muzzle and called herself 20 different kinds of stupid. Whoever was down there wasn't even trying to keep quiet. She felt for her cell phone, habit, useless. Her cabin sat at the far and unreliable border of the phone's coverage area. Her position up the hill fell well into the dead zone. Her fingers moved past the phone and fastened on the 45 with a snick as she thumbed off the safety, another alien noise in the pre-dawn hush. Mary Alice eased onto her stomach by centimeters. The slick fabric of her puffy down jacket made soft, whispery sounds as she set the gun in front of her, resting her wrist on a flat rock. She'd hauled the rock into place the night before, back when she'd attributed the whole elaborate setup to the paranoia resulting from working too long on a story turned too strange. "It's never as bad as you think," her friend Lola liked to say, of everything from meals to men to the various stories they chased as young reporters in Baltimore. "It's worse." Lola's plane would land in just a few hours. They hadn't seen one another in 5 years. When Lola had gone off to Afghanistan and Mary Alice to Montana, career paths that had run parallel for years suddenly diverging. Lola had promised some war stories when she arrived. Mary Alice closed her eyes and contemplated the fact that she'd have a war story of her own once this night was over. Cold pinched her exposed wrist. He'd been in the cabin a long time, probably at her desk, strewn with files baited with misleading labels, flash drives filled with meaningless junk. If she'd called it right, he'd scoop it all up, assume he'd gotten what he came for, and drive away, giving her a precious few seconds to glimpse his face before he got into his car. She wondered how long she should stay up on the hill after he left, then realized she'd never actually heard him drive up. She opened her eyes. Mist pooled in the clearing below, the darkness cottony around the edges, dawn commencing. He knelt on the porch, solid and dark and real in the vaporous light, sighting Mary Alice through the scope of an AR-15, its barrel steadied on the porch railing. A hat shielded his face, but she had no trouble imagining the crosshairs centered on her own. The sturdy 45, so comforting moments before, felt like a toy in her shaking hand. 50 yards was pushing the limits of its range. By the time her bullet slowed in a tumbling fall toward the porch, his would have punched through her and beyond, just getting warmed up on its unerring way. The dog began to bark. Mary Alice dropped the gun and raised her hands high. So, yee, dun dun dun.
Need to turn the page.
I hope so. So the funny thing about that prologue, the whole book stemmed from that. I had written an earlier novel set in Afghanistan that my agent worked and worked to try to sell and couldn't. And she said, write another book. You know, fine, sure, oh, that's yeah, easy. Right. And I had, you know, I rooted through all my stuff and I had this fragment, which essentially is this prologue that I had written and just discarded. And I pulled it out again and I thought, well, you know, why is this woman up on this hill? Who's that guy? What's going on here? So I wrote a little more, and then I wrote a little more, and that's how the book happened.
When I read the prologue, you know, I did want to turn the page, and I did want to keep reading. It was very engaging. But I thought maybe you had written that last.
No, it came first. And as I said, then the rest of the book came from that. I had to figure out what was going on, too.
Well, I think that's the secret to a really good story, is when the writer has to be curious about what's going to happen. Mary Alice and Lola had been friends, as we mentioned, for a long time, but they were starting to drift apart because of their very different lifestyles. And one of the scenes that I noted, and maybe because this is something that happens with me, is a friend or a family member will write you a long, detailed email. You know, something you would have gotten in a letter maybe 15 years ago, but now they're in emails and you're working during your workday and you kind of glance at it and you scan it and you think, I'll come back later and send a nice response. But that wasn't what was happening between them.
No, Mary Alice was quite taken with her new life in Montana and she was very intrigued with the people she was meeting and the places she was seeing. And she would write Lola exactly those sorts of long emails. And Lola's in Afghanistan. She's very taken with herself and her own importance, and she finds this completely uninteresting and ignores it. She could have benefited from reading those emails when she arrived in Montana.
Right, if she had read them before.
She'd have some grounding
attention
in the area, yeah. Exactly, instead of everything being completely strange.
But she just basically deleted them.
Right, yeah, right. And I think it was particular to her. She's such a lone wolf. I think she had been in a foreign country for so long where everyone was an other. So to come back to her own country, she had to relearn how to build friendships, even just build acquaintanceships with people, and how to build relationships again.
Yes, because when she first got to Mary Alice's town, she didn't make a very good impression.
No. She was very abrupt with people, like, just give me the information I need and let me go on my way. And please stop talking to me because I'm in a hurry. Yeah, she's kind of a pain in the butt.
And what I'm doing is more important than anything
exactly,
going on.
Exactly.
In your sad little life.
Yeah.
When you sold the first book, mm-hmm. did they just buy one or did they want more?
The publisher that bought this has a contract that gives them an option on your second book. They basically get the right of first refusal. Luckily, it took long enough to sell this book that by the time they took it, I had most of the second manuscript done. You know, as soon as I sent this book off to my agent, I immediately started writing the second one. So they got a look at that and decided immediately that they wanted it. One thing I found since I've quit working at the newspaper, this should come as no surprise, it is a whole lot easier to write when you have the luxury of writing full time than when you're trying to squeeze it in an hour before you go to work or a couple hours after you get home when you're exhausted. You know, I was just cranky all the time when I was writing Montana. That might possibly show up in Lola's character.
Yeah, she was a little cranky now and then. In the acknowledgments, you expressed gratitude to, quote, Nell for not eating the whole manuscript. There has to be a story behind that.
Nell is a young Brittany who is actually, she's three now, but being a bird dog, she is very active and she was a puppy when I was writing this book, and over the course of her puppyhood, she ate a couple of pairs of prescription glasses. She ate the TV remote. She ate many books. She would just pull them off the shelves and rip into them with great abandon. She basically ate everything she could get her little teeth around. And she slowed down a little bit now, but every so often, the other day she did grab a page as I was working on it and go romping away with it. And she keeps us on our toes.
The writer's version of the dog ate my homework.
Exactly. I thought she's probably my best excuse in some ways. Oh, that was a brilliant page, but darn, the dog ate it.
Gwen Florio lives in Missoula, Montana. There's more information about her at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, a link to audio in case you want to listen again or share this program with a friend, and links to the Write Questions podcast and Facebook page. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Cherie Newman wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.